Back in June last year, I started a series of messages looking at one of the most ignored books in the Old Testament, Ecclesiastes. And I started by saying that at first glance, it seems to be filled with despair and hopelessness. Someone reflecting on the uselessness of life. The title comes from the Greek translation of the Hebrew Koheleth, which we find in verse 1. Now, some of our English translations, the NIV, for example, call him the preacher. In other ones, we find him called the teacher. And in the Good News Bible, he's called the philosopher. Someone who mulls over the situation and tries to analyze what's going on. And in fact, many of Solomon's proverbs find an echo in Ecclesiastes. So it's likely that at the end of his tortuous life of wine, women, and song, when he's an older man, he looks back over his life and reflects on how he spent it. Chapter 1, verses 1 to 11, describe the meaningless of life under the sun. In other words, everything that happens down here. It's a sunny day today. Life under the sun is what takes place on the earth without any regard to God whatsoever. And he comes to the conclusion that life without God, life under the sun, is totally meaningless. Then, from verse 12 to the end of chapter 2, he analyzes what I called trivial pursuits. People going after this, after that, after the other, but nothing seems to make any sense. Then in chapter 3, he goes through the different seasons of life before deploring the fact that there is injustice everywhere. And so today we come to what I have called loneliness at the top. Carol read the passage a few minutes ago. Let's consider then these verses together. Back in 2020, the BBC published an article describing life in Japan. Life where there is a culture of doing overtime, which was so extreme, they invented a special word, karoshi. It comes from an idea that employees should demonstrate total commitment to their employer by the number of hours of work that they accomplish. The amount of time that they spend at their desks, the after-hours meetings with colleagues. And one high-profile case spoke of a 31-year-old reporter who died of heart failure, mobile phone in hand, having worked non-stop for 159 hours of overtime in a month, with only 2 days off. The Japanese government decided that was going too far, and so they introduced a law. But there were loopholes in the law, and that meant that some workers continued to be exploited and nothing changed. People worked themselves literally to death. Now, most of us can't imagine that type of work ethic. And yet, many of us have done or continue to work very long hours. Why? What drives a workaholic? What drives us to work so hard and so long? Now, Christians obviously might say that it's because we're working to glorify God, and that is often true. But for many, it's probably only partially true. Isn't there an element there somewhere of working hard to climb the corporate ladder, to advance, to get more, to spend more time, and so on and so forth? If you don't believe me, just ask the Japanese. Fortunately, Koheleth provides us with a far better solution. In our passage, he encourages us to work more wisely, not for harder, but for longer, but more wisely. How? By making three specific choices. The first one, verses 4 to 6, I saw all toil and achievement spring from one person's envy of another. And then he finishes that by saying, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Now, I don't know whether my father ever preached on these verses, because he also was a pastor, but I do know that he had a motto, moderation in all things. The problem was he didn't live up to that when he was playing tennis. He used to scamper around the tennis court, and his enthusiasm and competitive spirit led him to winding up in hospital with a slipped disc. But I do know that he did give up a rewarding job in a solicitor's office in London in order to serve the Lord. It's all a question of getting the right balance. Look at these verses where Solomon contrasts the workaholic with the slothful person who just doesn't lift a finger. And then he goes on to strike the balance between the two extremes. So he's obviously observed what's going on in his kingdom. As a student of human nature and activity, he's scrutinized the behavior of the people around him. He's seen that people compete with one another all the time. And he uses the word all when speaking of all toil and all achievement. Now, of course, that's hyperbole. He's just pushing it to its extreme. But when you look at today and the social media, we've discovered people who are crazy about selfies, doing this in that particular situation to prove that they've been here, that they've done that, and that they're better than their colleagues or their friends or so on. And then there's peer pressure, pushing people to be better than others. There's a constant state of competition. People want to be more successful than their neighbours or their friends. They don't wear clothes because they need to. They change their wardrobe because they want to look better than the people next door. In the old days, it used to be keeping up with the Joneses. I'm not quite sure what the modern expression is these days. People don't necessarily buy a new car because they need a new one, or because of the ULIS laws coming into effect have forced them into buying a new car. They want to show off. There's so much competition, so much jealousy, so much rivalry, so much violence. Whether we admit it or not, that rivalry is one of the leading things that pushes people on. Now, of course, there are some people who've realized the evils of envy and rivalry and determined to be different. So they opt out. They don't want everyone to climb on to what they're doing, so they renounce any competitive endeavor at all, and that leads to the opposite extreme of going off the grid, as they call it. Verse 5 gives us another rendering of a proverb which is found twice in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 6:10 and 24:33. Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. In the original, it's they eat themselves. Now that seems a bit extreme, but again, Solomon is pushing it to extreme. He's saying that people refuse to work. They get so lazy they can't even bother to get up and feed themselves. Now again, he's pushing it to its extreme. But they don't work. They don't tend the garden. They just vegetate. Now, he's not advocating a return to the hippie movement of the 60s, where people festooned themselves with flowers, sat on the grass, smoked pot, and sang "We Shall Overcome." That group did give birth, however, to the Jesus movement and the Vineyard group of churches. So we mustn't reject it completely. There was something that came out of it. But what Solomon is saying, he talks about fools holding their hands and ruining themselves. Now, usually we associate the word fool with someone who's an idiot. That's not how the Bible uses it. The biblical meaning considers a fool as someone who denies God, refuses to accept that he is present, scoffs at wisdom, laughs at eternity. Foolishness in the scriptures is a rejection of God and contempt for his laws. God intends us to work. It's set out for us in scripture. That's why the evangelical churches like ours emphasize the importance of a godly work ethic. We believe that everyone who is physically able, mentally able, emotionally balanced, should work to the best of their ability. And we find it everywhere in the New Testament. Perhaps the best example is of the Apostle Paul, who together with Aquila and Priscilla made tents. And later, writing to the church at Thessalonica, he said this: "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." And then he goes on in Colossians: "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord and not for human masters." So the Bible is clear when it comes to work. We may have a monotonous job. We may have a very challenging job. Perhaps we have a job where we don't feel that we're appreciated. We must remember that we're doing it for the Lord. We're doing it as unto him. Work hard, smarter, not harder. And Solomon reveals his solution in verse 6: "Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind." So the wise person is the person who realizes that there is something which is far more important than just chasing after whatever we want. He tells us that there is more to it than what is simply physical. God will give us more. Now, I don't need to tell you about the cost of living crisis with many people struggling. But can I suggest that this passage teaches us that the problem is not so much the high cost of living, but the cost of high living. It's the other way around. People have become so accustomed to everything that they want more, even though they have it. Some of you may know that Taylor Swift is giving a concert in Paris this weekend. I looked at a report on TV this morning. There are people who have queued up for hours to go to that concert. There are people who have flown in from Peru and from the United States so that they can be at that concert. They're trying to save the planet, of course. Solomon goes on to tell us that we should choose relationships over riches. "Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone." These verses remind us that people should be our priority, not things. If we're so busy that we haven't got time for the people who matter the most to us, then we're too busy. Let me give you a fictitious example. I don't want to be misogynist, but let's imagine an average working married man who believes in the value of hard work and the dignity of a job well done, probably married, one or two, three children. He loves his wife, thinks about her more than she realizes, but he works long hours, leaving early in the morning, returning late. And the pressures of work mean that it takes him an hour or two to unwind when he gets home, so he doesn't spend much time talking. He might watch a bit of TV, read the paper, and go wearily to bed. His blood pressure is too high. He knows that his diet isn't great, that he needs exercise, but he hasn't got time. And though he works long hours, he doesn't consider himself to be a workaholic. Generally speaking, he loves his job and he's good at it. Thankfully, he has a good salary. He can thus provide for everything that his family needs. And one day, he plans to slow down. But that day hasn't arrived yet. So he swallows his coffee, dashes off to work, and comes home, and his family is gone. While he was at work, the kids grew up. His wife found a career of her own. His children moved out, and now the house is empty. He can't believe it. The board of directors have just named him CEO, and now there's no one to share it with because he's made it to the top and he's alone. Even if we aren't successful business people, I think we can probably relate to that kind of person. It's so easy to become consumed with our work that we have a hurry syndrome, always rushing here and there. We're busy people, so busy that very often we miss what's staring us in the face. And how many parents have sacrificed quality family time because they've been too busy? I've done it. When Carol and I moved from Tonon to Nantes for me to take over the pastorate of a small church, the children were changing schools, they were changing area, they didn't have friends, but my task was to meet all the members of the church and get to know them. And I was never at home for the children. And I live to regret that to this day, because it was wrong. I didn't have time for the people who mattered the most to me. And getting that work-life balance is very, very difficult. And how many famous people have made it to the top and found themselves to be alone? There's been depression, there's been drug abuse, there's been a lot of other things. Think of Kurt Cobain, Robin Williams, Marilyn Monroe, Caroline Flack, to name but a few. They had it all, but there was something missing. Like Zacchaeus, rich but dissatisfied. Choose friendships wisely. Two are better than one, writes Solomon, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. We don't need to be alone. He speaks about friendship and community, and in verses 9 to 12, he lists several benefits of friendship. Friends improve results. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. Relationships grow out of sharing work, be it in laboring, in mission trips, in service projects. any kind of church ministry. Two people can combine their strengths, their creativity, their talent, their ambition. There's something special about working together with at least one other person. There's a bond that is created when people work and serve together. In other words, work smarter, not harder. Friends help in trouble, verse 10, because people do feel lonely. Many men raised with a sort of macho attitude that we don't need help, that it's not manly to depend on somebody else. What a lot of rubbish. Fortunately, here we have Band of Brothers between the men that we meet once a month on a Friday evening. It's important that we do that because we share. The ladies, women of the word, know that they need other ladies with whom they can share. And together we've learned a number of truths about building each other up, working smarter, not harder. And friends, warm each other. If two lie down together, they will keep warm. How can one keep warm alone? If you are married here this morning, does your wife have cold feet? If I believed in reincarnation, I could well believe that my wife used to be a polar bear in a life previous to the one that she has now. One of my most difficult acts of service is to allow her to warm her feet on me. Now, you may not have that problem. You may have an electric blanket. But in ancient days, cold was much more of a serious issue than it is today. When people were forced to sleep in the open or in a tent, the more people that could huddle together, the warmer they would be. So Solomon says that two are better than one in keeping warm. The same is true in the natural world. If you have a fire, if you have a log burner, if you take one log out and leave it on its own, the fire is going to go out. To maintain the heat, it needs to be with the others. And when Christians stop meeting together, when they don't come together to worship God together, the fire goes out. We come together to create a bonfire of fellowship so that we may set one another aflame with zeal for serving the Lord, working smarter, not harder. Friends, support one another. Koheleth closes his thoughts in this section with these words: though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. We need other people to give us the strength that we need in times of persecution, in times of hardship. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken was a proverbial way of saying there is strength in numbers. Now, that little phrase has often been used in Christian marriages, but you can see from the context it has nothing to do with marriage at all. Solomon is observing that we all face trials and tests of our faith, and we need someone at hand to keep us on track. Choose influence over popularity. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to heed a warning. These verses remind us that popularity doesn't last. Some commentators believe that Solomon is referring to his own family, but I think that's unlikely, because he presents a succession of kings, none of whom fully satisfies his subjects. You can pass from the bottom of society to the top of society. Not everyone will appreciate you. And it's impossible to please everyone, so it's foolish spending all one's time trying to please everybody. Presidents and prime ministers may have extremely high approval ratings for a while, but they don't last. Consider what happened to Winston Churchill at the end of World War II. He was ousted because although he had been largely responsible for winning the war, he hadn't looked after the Conservative Party. Many years later, George W. Bush was popular, but he lied about the weapons of mass disruption and started economic meltdown. As one American coach said of some of his players, today you're in the penthouse, tomorrow in the doghouse. What's true of sporting stars is often true of pastors, civil servants, teachers, and others. Popularity just doesn't last. Today's heroes are tomorrow's rejects. This summer, the Olympic Games are taking place in Paris, and people will be striving for gold. In 1984, there was an American diver, Greg Louganis. He won a double gold medal in his event, and he repeated that feat 4 years later, and he was hailed as being the world's greatest diver. But by 2012, he was facing financial ruin. He was forced to sell his home, auction his medals to raise cash. Tennis star Boris Becker amassed a multi-million pound fortune, but lost it all. And his friend Pat Cash said of him, Boris has always felt a need to maintain an image linked with prosperity. What a waste. What can we learn then from this passage? What can we apply to our lives? From the outset, Koheleth has been showing us that all achievements, all riches, all popularity vanish like Hebel, a morning mist. It just goes, and you can't get it back again. Three pursuits are so temporary, not worth pursuing. So he encourages us to work smarter, not harder. Trusting God, loving people, enjoying life in His service. And I'll come back to a verse in closing that I've already mentioned. Colossians chapter 3. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, yes, but as working for the Lord, not for human masters. May the Lord encourage us and take us forward as we work together for Him. Amen.